Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are very happy that you have joined us on this this post-snowy day. A little slow going for a lot of folks, but we are thrilled that you are with us and that we have a lot to talk about. Yesterday was a busy day, so we will delve in and talk about things that are going on. Let us introduce the panel. As I mentioned, the media project ran a little long, the taping, so the panelists are coming in now, but let me introduce everybody who's in the studio. Communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa. Lovely to see you.
Good morning. Delighted to be here.
Thank you very much. We also welcome Jim Henler, who we were just talking about our Don Knotts question, and oh, Ira, you missed that. Jim is the Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Daily Freeman Publisher Emeritus, newly freed from the clutches of the Media Project, joins us in the studio. Good morning, Ira.
Good morning. Nice to be back.
Very nice to have you back, sir. And WAMC's Alan Chartok joins us. Good morning, Alan.
Here I am, Big Joe.
Excellent.
And I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we are delighted to have you here, and we are delighted that our whole group is here to talk about what has happened over the last 24 hours, and we welcome you, our listening audience, to join in, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, well, what happened yesterday? My goodness. So... We'll talk about Cohen first. I understand, of course, that what's happening in Vietnam and with Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un. We will talk about that in a moment. But I do want to start with Cohen's testimony and what happened there yesterday. It was quite a day. A lot of it was tense. There was a lot going on, and sometimes it was a little hard to figure out what was really bad, and what was really, really, really bad. Cohen drops an ominous hint that Trump faces legal peril in testimony to the House Oversight Committee. Michael Cohen alleged that President Trump manipulated financial records, paid to cover up extramarital affairs, and reacted with glee when he learned in advance of a WikiLeaks dump of emails damaging to Hillary Clinton. All of this yesterday, as I mentioned, in testimony before the House Oversight Committee that we did air live. It started at about 10 o'clock in the morning and did not end until about 5:20 in the afternoon. The man who once derived his identity from making President Trump's problems go away turned on his former boss in stunning fashion Wednesday, alleging to Congress that Trump manipulated financial records, paid to cover up extramarital affairs, and reacted with glee upon learning the WikiLeaks anti-secrecy organization would release emails damaging to his political opponent. Michael Cohen, Trump's former fixer and personal lawyer, cast the president as a petty racist who enlisted those around him to propagate a culture of deceit in business during his campaign and after winning the White House. In testimony before the committee, Cohen revealed how, in his view, Trump broke the law, even as president, and he suggested ominously that federal prosecutors remain interested in a case involving the president. The other thing that I want to mention right before we go to our panelists is how the Republicans reacted to all of this. The president and his Republican allies sought to portray Cohen as a fabulist, disgruntled because Trump wouldn't give him a job in the White House, and now hoping to get rich with a possible movie or book deal arising from specious claims about the president and those closest to him. There were a lot of people. One was Representative Paul Gosar, right, of Arizona. You're a pathological liar. You don't know truth from falsehood. There was a lot of irony yesterday.
I don't even know where to start with it.
You can say that again. Irony is exactly the right word.
Hypocrisy. Irony.
I mean, here is this guy who the Washington Post has added up to, you know, the last time I looked, and that was several weeks ago, was 7,000 lies.
Now, Elijah Cummings, during the testimony, said it was now up to 8,600.
86.
Yeah.
that 86 what, thousand?
8,600.
I thought I heard closer to 10,000.
So here is the liar in chief, and he's, and obviously they were so organized. It was as if they sat in a room together, these Republicans, and decided, senators, and decided, excuse me, congressmen, and decided who was going to get to say what terrible thing. I think they've made a terrible error here. Just two observations. One, I truly was disappointed in the Cohen hearings because it wasn't specific enough. Now, I think he had a muzzle on about the Russian thing. We know that. We know that that was a deal with the Mueller people, I believe. But I didn't hear anything that was the kind of crime which I think would make those Republican senators reconsider their position. It certainly wasn't paying off Stormy Daniels. You know, he dismisses that and he says, that was only because I felt sorry for her because I wanted to pay her off. I didn't want to hurt my family. Then, so I don't think that's enough in terms of a campaign violation. Not only that, I was interested in when he indicated that there was other investigations going on, but we didn't hear about them. So that's where I am.
Ira?
I just want to frame this, and the experts in the room and on the timeline could straighten me out if I'm wrong. But the purpose of a hearing such as yesterday in the normal world is to gather information. This is an oversight committee. Republicans and Democrats, they ask the witness questions and they gather information and do with it what they will. That clearly was not the case yesterday. The Republicans come in with a sign on the wall saying, liar, liar. I mean, what kind of nonsense, juvenile behavior is that? And the questioning from the Republicans was not after listening to Cohen's statement probing some of the allegations that he made against Trump. Instead, he's saying, you're a liar, you're a liar, you're a liar, you're a liar, don't believe it. Well, okay, there are many people who believe that that's the case and perhaps disbelieved everything that Cohen said. Nonetheless, that's not what the purpose of this hearing was supposed to be. Am I right about that? Isn't a hearing supposed to be just that, a hearing?
Teresa?
Well, I thought in terms of the substance of the hearing, what they did was connect a lot of dots of information we already know. So a lot of what we assumed happened, he just affirmed it happened. But I thought for the Republicans, the biggest tell was not that they tried to discredit Cohen. One would anticipate that. You could, the White House signaled that. But that they didn't really try to undermine what Cohen said about Trump.
Yep.
I thought that was the biggest tell, the most revealing thing. And so in the sense that they did what they could do, but I thought Cummings' closing statement was really profound, in which he kept talking about, we have to get back to our democracy. People are going to remember what you did in 2019 in terms of protecting our democracy. And when he kept saying, you got caught up in this, he was saying it to Cohen, but I think he was saying it not just to Cohen, but to the committee, to the Republicans, to Americans. You know, you've gotten caught up in this, and we can't normalize this. It's not right.
Jim?
Yeah, I felt like it was political theater, not politics, and I was just very disappointed. The other interesting thing was I missed a lot of it yesterday. I actually had to go to work.
You didn't see
meeting.
It, but you didn't miss it.
Yeah, that's right. But interestingly, I watched a lot of the coverage on both MSNBC and Fox, and I swear they were at two different hearings. I mean, the overlap in the news coverage. So again, this whole thing is becoming about appealing to a sector, talking to some group, making sure that the sound bites get out there so you'll be quoted on Twitter. I mean, and I think it's been getting worse for a lot of years, but the past couple of years with this president, I think that's really what I see has happened.
But
we've just become all about putting some kind of message in front of someone, but not a positive message anymore. It's just, what can you do? Who can you hurt? It's a horrible politics.
I watch Fox, too, but the question is about normalizing this behavior.
Exactly.
I mean, this is not, I mean, we've, over time, and I think that's what Chairman Cummings was trying to say, we shouldn't be normalizing this behavior.
To Alan's point.
What grade, Teresa, would you give Chairman Cummings on his performance yesterday?
Well, I thought he did a good job of handling the hearing. Why do you, what?
Well, the reason I'm asking is I'm getting a lot of mail here that is saying Cummings for president. So whatever he did, he clearly connected with an awful lot of people with his sensibility, for want of a better word.
Right. I mean, I thought his closing statement was absolutely profound. I thought he was sending a message, not just, I'm repeating myself, but not just to Cohen, but to the committee, to the Republicans, to the country.
But also, wasn't that in contrast to Mark Meadows, who I didn't know I didn't like him as much until yesterday. But
I knew.
Yeah, okay. Well, I knew we weren't of the same cloth. However, I didn't know that I actively disliked him like I do now. But then there's the so there's that contrast. But even to Cohen, who, you know, you would think, okay, well, this guy was a snake, and you didn't, and he comes off calm and did a pretty good job from all accounts of not losing it. Well, I think once or twice he took them to task, but for the most part was a pretty good witness considering what they were throwing at.
I thought he was really believable, Joe.
Yeah.
And not only that, if you looked at him carefully as he was testifying, he cried a couple of times. I mean, he was wiping his eyes. I think if there's anything like genuine remorse, there it was.
You know, I compare watching Cohen to watching Kavanaugh. It's just, you know, again, it's of the two, the one who came off as sincere and caring was the guy who's a known crook and the guy I hate
is going to jail.
And the guy who's now on the Supreme Court and will eventually be ruling whether this guy can be pardoned.
Well,
or not.
Cohen is such, was such an SOB when he was working for Trump, and self admits it, of course, now, right. and feel badly for his family. But you know, I didn't feel particularly warm towards him either yesterday.
I don't know if feeling warm, but I thought he did a good job of given what he was.
Well, if he told the truth, he's got a lot of truth to tell, and it was convincing.
But I thought he was contrite, and I also thought that, you know, he pointed to what others have been saying for a while, Governor Christie and others, is that this is really going to play out in the Southern District of New York, right? The Mueller report, of course, will be important, but in terms of crimes and culpability, that's going to play out in places.
Well, no less an expert than Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, was saying that very early on when he was on all the programs, that they said this is the case that's going to be the big difference.
Alan?
So, Teresa, what do you think it will take in terms of a crime in order to lead to an impeachment? As you know, I've been fighting with some of my friends from you know, the more liberal left side of the aisle, who think he should be impeached, the president, right now. And you take a look at what those senators were saying yesterday, and you say, what, those guys are going to vote for impeachment? That's ridiculous. So what would it take?
Right. Well, I'm not on the impeachment bandwagon. I think he needs to be voted out of office. But I think the question is, what do we do about adhering to the rule of law? And I think that the question is, what will it take to be impeached? Some very close connection to the Russians. But I don't even know if we have, you know, the clock is running on this. I think
so. I'm sorry, Teresa, but so assume for a moment that you're right and it's the Russians that would do it. Would these characters in the United States Senate, the Republicans who face primaries, if they turn on Trump, is there anything that would make them go? Right now, I haven't seen any hint of it.
I saw a statistic last night. We've been talking about this, but here's the most recent number. According to the Gallup poll, Trump's support among Republicans is at 89.
That's incredible.
But I do think, though, Alan, again, the thing that was most telling to me yesterday was the nuance of what the Republicans, not so much what they were saying, but what they were not saying. They did not come to his defense on the substance of the legal questions. They avoided that.
Meaning Trump's defense.
To Trump's defense, yes. On the substance of the, you know, alleged wrongdoing. And they attacked Cohen's character. But they did not give Trump, they gave him cover in terms of saying, you know, this guy's a liar, Cohen. But they did not attack him on the substance except for the issue of race. and whether or not he's a racist.
So that says to you what he's got one foot. They're ready to flee as long as they believe it. Fleeing makes sense for them.
They are not, in terms of the legal jeopardy that he's in, they're not side by side with him on the legal jeopardy. So, I thought that that was most telling. Yeah. Sorry.
So let's just have about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay, so let's take Ira's point of the 87% of the Republicans, which is down a bit, I think, but it's huge compared to the idea of courage on the part of the senators. They tell everybody they don't like them.
But that
they tell everybody they don't like them off the record, but they're scared to death of them.
But that gets to Jim's point, though, which is what you see on Fox is completely different.
Right.
But I think the bigger question is, what does this matter? What does this matter to all of us?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll let that hold for a moment. We do have to take a break. We come back. We will come back, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and then we'll also, of course, talk about North Korea as well. We'll be back right after this. Well, not surprisingly, we have a lot of letters, so we'll go to those. And we are waiting for, at 10 o'clock this morning, the governor of New York will be joining Alan at just after 10. So we have an abbreviated forum this morning, so we're going to get as much in as we possibly can. We'll do the letters, and then we'll move on to North Korea, and then we'll go from there. All right. Jamie says, I would like to say that someday... I'd like to see that someday Republicans will be held accountable for positions they are taking, both supporting Donald Trump and operating as if only capitalism and profits have any legitimate claim on government time. I'd like to say it, but I doubt it's true. With all our technology and recording of everything, it all seems to have little effect on how America votes. Is it a presentation issue?
No, you know, I do. I think that's wrongheaded. Truly, all due respect to the letter writer. I think what's happened here is that we just saw an overwhelming congressional election that brings the Democrats back into power. And frankly, I think these guys in the Senate are between a rock and a hard place. They know full well what happened, and they know the blue wave is on. It's going to be on double the next time out, and that they'll be they picked up two seats, but there was all safe seats that they were defending. Not next time. So if they had some brains, they'd get out of the way, in my opinion, and they should know that.
Bob writes, congressional hearings are supposed to be exercises in listening, but yesterday the Republicans on the committee desperately tried to avoid listening to Cohen, instead using their time trying to distract the American people from hearing solid testimony backed by corroborating evidence. It's hard to imagine that anybody was fooled by their antics, except, of course, the know-nothings who will never let truth interfere with their love affair with Trump. I did think it was interesting there were a few times where certain Republicans would say, this is my time, as Cohen was trying to answer the question. And it was like, well, and you're supposed to be asking him, but oh well. Richard says, laying the groundwork and preparing that Cohen is laying the groundwork and preparing the people for the Mueller report. Patricia said one of the comments that hasn't gotten much attention from yesterday is Cohen's warning that if defeated in 2020, Trump would make a power move to retain power. What do you all think?
Bill Maher has been saying that for about a year, that if Trump loses the election, he's not going to want to leave. I don't even know if he could stoop that low, but who the heck knows?
Well, again, I think that gets back to Chairman Cummings' remarks about what each of us are doing in 2019 to keep our democracy intact.
Sonia says it bears mentioning that AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a freshman lawmaker, was one of the few that asked pointed questions that helped build a case for tax fraud and possibly other actionable crimes committed by President Trump and others in his organization. I'm looking forward to someone leaking Trump's school records now that I know how hard he tried to hide them. That's going to be like the taxes, though, right? I mean, you're not supposed to leak them.
You know, right. I got to say, one of my favorite things about the AOC thing was, you know, she asked these pointed questions, actually elicited some information. And someone asked her, you know, you didn't go to law school, you didn't have that training. How did you learn to do that? And she said, I was a bartender in New York.
She comes from my neighborhood in Parkchester.
So I'm impressed.
How else could it not be?
But
you know what to ask. You know, go ahead.
I thought that actually they did a very, Cummings did a very good job in orchestrating this, in the sense that they clearly, a range of Democrats had different sets of issues, different ground that they wanted to cover. And I thought a number of them did a very good job of asking questions and eliciting key information on a broad range of topics, which then, you know, gives folks, you know, reinforces a range of points. I thought she did a good job, but I thought a number of them did.
Sherry brings up an interesting point, and then we'll move on to North Korea. She said, no one asked Cohen if Pence was knowledgeable of Trump's activities.
Right. That's one area where I thought was, that's a very important point for the writer. Yeah, where was Pence in all of this? I think that's still a mystery. He's traveling a lot outside the country. He's not being held accountable, but he was there all along the way. I think it's very important.
I thought one other thing struck me near the end of this session, and perhaps I'm more sensitive to it because of my background, but as they were going through, I want a unanimous consent to enter something into the proceedings, they reeled off the name, three or four congressmen reeled off the names of four or five newspaper articles, some of them from the, you know, Washington Post, LA Times, some of them from Mother Jones, which, you know, is not one of their regular reading materials. And I'm thinking to myself, gee, how fake could the fake news be if they want to enter all of this fake news into the record? So yeah. That's just me.
All right. Alan, anything else?
No, I'm still trying to sort this whole thing out, as I think most people who listened are. Joe, just a personal gripe, for whatever it's worth. You and I both know we talk about this, you and I, a lot. And that is, we had planned to play the president from Vietnam this morning.
Right.
And at 3:30. And then what happened was that the president left early, and he gave his press conference at 1 something in the morning. And I just wanted to explain to people that NPR left us in the lurch. I was a little ticked off, to be honest with you, because we always try to put these hearings and these press conferences before people so that they can figure out for themselves what's going on. I'm sorry if that's inappropriate, Joe, but I wanted to explain.
No, I don't think it's inappropriate at all. We had a situation. Actually, I'll just take it one step further. We had a situation when the national emergency was being declared by the president, and NPR said they would go to the press conference. And you expect this president to go off script and to ramble, and that's exactly what he did. And about 15 minutes into it, NPR made the decision to bail.
And to cut away.
Missing really the key declaration of the national emergency, but also the Q&A.
So they turn off the microphone, so even if you choose, your station
correct.
Wants to run it.
Yes, correct.
Choice.
Correct.
Yes, and Ira, and the other answer to that, this is all sausage making and inside baseball, but the other answer to that is we have our ways. We can find that stuff if we are given warning that they're going
right,
to do that.
Right.
If they don't give us warning, we've gone to our friend Steve Baboulis at Channel 13 sometimes, and when they're doing something, they give it to us. Or we've gone to the BBC, for example, and they had it. So we could have done it, but they just didn't tell us.
Yeah, and the plan that they had, they aborted, and that was unfortunate. But you're absolutely right. It is frustrating, especially when you're talking about things like this with the press conference. We will, but let us talk about what happened in Hanoi and or what didn't happen. I don't know. I think Trump and Kim abruptly cut short the summit. They failed to reach an agreement to dismantle North Korea's nuclear weapons. Kim Jong-un has said he was ready in principle to denuclearize, but talks broke down over economic sanctions. Basically, they wanted the sanctions lifted in their entirety, and we couldn't do that, said President Trump. And that was many people going into this meeting were saying how important it was for the president. I know we said it on this program to come out with a win of however that is defined. And it certainly seems that did not happen. Talks collapsed unexpectedly amid the disagreement with the two leaders and their delegations departing their meeting site in Vietnam's capital without sitting for a planned lunch or participating in a scheduled signing ceremony. Kim said he was prepared in principle to denuclearize. I mentioned that. Trump said the main impediment to a deal was Kim's requirement that the U.S. lift all economic sanctions on North Korea in exchange for the closure of only one nuclear facility, which still would have left Pyongyang with a large arsenal of missiles and warheads. My sense of this, and I'm interested in what the panel thinks, my sense of this is that there were many advisors on both the U.S. and the North Korea side who knew this was the case, who knew that coming to any deal was not possible, and had suggested that point, Mike Pompeo being one of them. And yet, the president went ahead, said, I can win this, went in, and what a lot of skeptics predicted is exactly what happened.
But, Joe, one of the things that was so interesting to me here, there are a couple of things. First of all, at the very end of his remarks, which have been played over and over again, there is the indication that he was going to sell out too cheaply. We knew that he was going to go in and say, right. Okay, as long as they don't fire the missiles, that's okay. And that's a win for us. Well, he had already achieved that. The second thing is he tried to blame the Democrats and Cummings and the hearings for his loss in Vietnam. And that was extraordinary, I thought. It was more chutzpah than I have seen in a long time.
Yeah, that is a lot.
Well, the benefit of having the low expectations that Trump and his administration have is that the way this ended, he can tout this as showing his strength from walking away from the table, because too many people, myself included, were afraid he was going to give away the store. And the fact that he did not give away the store, in fact, didn't give away anything, accrues to his benefit in a backhanded sort of way. But I think Joe's point or Alan's point is correct. Normally, when a president goes to a summit like this, all of the heavy lifting is done before they get there. And then when they get there, they shake hands and have shrimp cocktail. And this time they shook hands, had shrimp cocktail, and didn't have a successful conclusion. And I'm not sure, again, whether Trump should be praised for pulling the brakes on it or vilified for taking it to the point that it was.
I don't want to monopolize this here, but I do think that there is a question for all of us about whether there is a turning point for the Republican senators, as we've been talking about. The one place where they seem to be really antsy is over this question of national security. With Putin, it turned out a lot of them were quite angry. And now with this, I think the president and his people saw they need them desperately to avoid impeachment and the rest of it, and they can't afford to undermine a sense of national security with these Republican senators who figure it comes first. Teresa, what do you think?
Well, I think that the I think you're right, Alan, about the Senate Republicans on national security issues. And I think we have we're in some deep trouble right now globally. I think that while the Trump will try to spin it that he was tough and walked away, the fact of the matter is any expert knows that this should have never happened to begin with, that Trump saying, you know, I got a meeting with Kim when other people didn't, is just the opposite of the reality of these issues, that Kim got what he wanted. He got a platform on the same level as the President of the United States. So that was a win for him. And he got that without giving anything up. And I think that Trump came in with a weak hand. You should not go into these without a planned outcome. And I also think that we have to be very concerned about what's going on in India and Pakistan, that is the biggest news yesterday, I think, was not what was going on in Hanoi, not going on what was going on with the Cummins hearing, but what was going on with India and Pakistan. And at
you
the
bet.
Same time, you had China, Russia, and India meeting and agreeing to boost trilateral ties. They're meddling in Venezuela. The world knows that Donald Trump is weak in that he doesn't understand global politics and policy, and that he's not listening to his international advisors.
Jim?
Yeah, and I think the other thing in this, and, you know, Teresa, I'm sure you know this too, those of us who sort of hang out down in D.C. and work with people who are on all these agencies, committees, et cetera, the State Department has become a ghost town. It's unbelievable how many unfilled positions are. There are young people who used to go to the diplomatic corps are avoiding it. And so, you know, Trump has not only himself having the doesn't know what he's doing, but he got rid of all the people who actually understood these things and where are the flashpoints and what should we do and not do. And it just scares me that, you know, we're trusting, quote, his gut, which of
and
course
as you know,
is better
Jim,
than anything else.
And as you know, Stalin did the same thing previous to World War II. He killed all the generals, and it almost cost them everything.
And I think, Alan, that with the India-Pakistan conflict right now, two nuclear powers fighting in the past, the U.S. would step in and try to help calm that situation. I was delighted to hear this morning that the Pakistanis have agreed to give back the soldier they took. But in Venezuela, the gutting of the State Department really plays a part in all of this. And the fact that he and the people around him are not listening. If he was listening to his State Department, his Defense Department, there would not have been a Hanoi meeting.
Right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we have more letters. We'll go to those, and then we'll finish up before Governor Andrew Cuomo. I keep on wanting to say Mario. I know I'm going to do that one of these days. We'll be right back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Let's go to some letters, and then we'll wrap up this edition. We go to Dan, who writes, "Why are politicians and the media treating the idea of North Korean nuclearization as a serious possibility? Does anyone on the panel truly think they would? At best, they'll agree to give up their weapons in exchange for a big basket of goodies, and then they will cheat and will discover that nothing has changed. Nuclear weapons are the only thing they have that can command respect from the rest of the world."
That's true. And of course, China would be delighted if we declared the war over and took out U.S. troops from the region as well. I mean, this is pretty precarious.
Russell writes, "If Donald Trump is found guilty of crimes, wouldn't that make his Republican supporters in the Congress accessories? Because there's absolutely no way they couldn't have already known it to be true." Well, no, right?
Wouldn't you love to see them pull the paddy wagon up behind the entrance to the Congress and they go off one right after the other?
But, Laura, go ahead.
But, you know, just people voted for that. I mean, we have to remember that a lot of this people knew before the election, and they voted for it. And that's the thing we really have to get a handle on. We have to understand how this happened and how to have it change the next time.
Laura says, "I listened to most of the testimony yesterday and was disgusted by how the Republicans handled the whole thing. They behaved like partisan hacks defending a criminal president instead of trying to get to the truth of the matter. I found their whole act full of hypocrisy. It was disgusting. I still cannot fathom how they still garner an 80% plus approval rating amongst their supporters for this nonsense. Even though I don't like Michael Cohen, I found his testimony heartfelt and spot on. The issues he raised are serious for our democracy."
You know, we shouldn't forget, because I was critical of the Republicans, that when regardless of who the majority party is, if there is a hearing, inevitably, the congressman will use the opportunity to give a speech, and the speech will be concurrent with the general point of view of which side is which. The difference yesterday, I thought, was even after, say, in this case, the Republicans might give a disapproving speech regarding the witness, they nonetheless would ask a question. That wasn't the extent of their remarks as, "We don't believe you, you're a liar." They would at least try to elicit some information that might be handled in such a way that it would sway one way or the other. There was no pretense of that yesterday. This was simply, "We don't believe you."
Don't you get the idea there, Ira, that the line between Air Force One and those Republican congressmen must have been pretty busy?
Yes.
I mean, it was so clearly, a way of doing it that it just had the tone of the president and his people being scared out of their wits as to what was going to come out of this thing.
And by the way, you alluded to him talking about it's the Democrats' fault. I heard one of the commentators this morning as I was driving up pointing out that the Republicans in the Senate had called Cohen to testify yesterday, I believe it was, the day before yesterday.
Tuesday.
And originally he had it was postponed because of illness. And so it was, in fact, the Republicans that set up the timing mechanism that got Cohen in the in the pit this week.
Well, it was Trump tweets where he was attacking the family, and then they had threats.
Oh, that's why they postponed it.
They had threats on his family.
So the Republicans were the ones who set up the hearing the day before yesterday.
A very good point, Irv.
But, you know, going back to some of this, I was actually I really want to figure out how to get something. I'm not good at video editing and stuff, but I actually sort of went back, watched some Watergate clips.
Yeah.
Right.
Then I watched some Clinton hearing clips. Then I watched you can just see the degradation you were talking about in the national discourse. The Watergate, you really felt like both sides wanted to know what was going on. Even the defenders were probing. By the Clinton trial, it was character assassination,
right.
But even the Democrats were trying to get information. It didn't feel like it was just, you know, liar. And then this, it's like kindergarten.
Yeah, and to Alan's point, I'm sorry, Teresa, but to Alan's point of the lines being ablaze between Air Force One and the Republicans on Capitol Hill, you could hear that in Meadows almost at the beginning of taking that play from the Kavanaugh playbook of just yelling. Of just that and saying the same thing and just yelling very harshly and with, I don't know, real regard to what was happening.
The Republicans seemed uncomfortable to me, that they were put in an uncomfortable spot in defending Trump on this. And they didn't probe. I mean, they're not going to probe because if they probe on the substance, it's not good for their guy, right? And so that's at some point. What side of the democracy are they going
to
be
on? Weren't you surprised to learn of the apparent close relationship between Meadows and Cummings? They were talking about near the end.
I knew that.
You knew that?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
That's a thing.
That's a thing.
No, it's like.
We didn't know that was a thing. That's a thing. All right.
No, that there are people, there are some Republicans and Democrats who you wouldn't, wouldn't assume it, but they're close friends.
Well, that whole stunt where, whether or not you want to call Meadows a racist, that whole stunt with him propping up this woman as an example of why Trump is not a racist.
That was obscene.
Just obscene.
We got this letter from Austin in Schenectady who says, I've only listened to coverage by NPR, and I certainly haven't heard all of that. But one thing to which I've heard no reference at all is to the part of Mr. Cohen's final statement in which he expressed fear that if Trump loses 2020, we will not see a peaceful transition of power. Well, we did talk about that. Bearing in mind the way that Trump was prepping his followers to believe that election fraud would be responsible if he'd lost in 2016, any thoughts on this? Was this just self-justifying hot air or ...
Nothing would surprise me, and that's why I said, I don't remember, forget if I was on the air, but the Democrats' initial foray into this 2020 race troubles me because we're seeing a lot of divisiveness and we're seeing a lot of conversation that could prompt independents, people who might want to go back from Trump to the Democrats to have second thoughts, and we can't open the door for that.
But I think we have to pay attention also what's going on in the world. We had Kushner in Saudi Arabia the last 2 days in negotiations with Saudi Arabia, not calling them out to task at all on Yemen. You know, I was thinking how ironic it is here. The U.S. is complicit in helping Saudi Arabia block food going into Yemen, while at the same time we are in Venezuela complaining because of the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela where they won't let food in. I mean, what are we?
And
as
don't
a country?
Forget Khashoggi.
Right, and they didn't mention Khashoggi. Exactly right. Where is the what? And I think this is what was Cummings was trying to say. What's the heart and soul of our country?
Okay, but the letter is frightening. I've said on our air that I don't think Trump would stop at anything, and I do worry for the Republic. I do worry, but I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think the armed forces, for example, which would have to be involved in what the letter implies, would ever stand for it. I just don't think it would happen. But would I think that it's possible that Trump would try something like that? I do. Based on my reading of his character, yes, I do.
Yep. You know, I agree, Alan. And I do want to say, you know, one of the things that I've actually found over the past couple of years is the strength of our democracy. I mean, Trump has tried to destroy things left and right that he didn't agree with, and the resilience, because we have the court system, because we have that. I mean, you know, it's all trying to change. They're trying to fix things their way. But at least, you know, the voting in 18, the way things are moving, the Democrats being able to actually do things, on an optimistic day, I'm happy about that. We still live in a pretty and amazing country.
All right. Well, we'll leave it on your optimistic note. Because I can't think of any other way that we'll leave on an optimistic note. So we'll do that. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Jim Hendler, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Communications Consultant Teresa Bourgeois, and Daily Freeman Publisher Emeritus Ira Fussfeld. Thank you all for being with us this morning. We appreciate it. Alan, you stay put. You'll be interviewing Governor Cuomo in just a moment, and we'll do all of that right after the news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the discussion between Dr. Alan Chartok and the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
Always a pleasure. Alan, you are with us as well. Go to it.
So, Governor, with all of the stuff about a pleasure to be with you, a pleasure to have you, is it really a pleasure? I mean, what are you really thinking?
What am I really thinking? Dr. Envy. Dr. Envy. You know, I have a sister who's a doctor.
Yes.
She's the favorite. You know, the joke about the doctor and the attorney, I'll tell you very quickly because I know you're precious with your time. Mm-hmm. Two sons, one becomes a doctor, one becomes an attorney.
Right.
The attorney always believes that the mother favors the doctor's son, so the attorney's very motivated and works very hard and then goes into politics and becomes a congressperson and then a U.S. senator and then runs for president of the United States because he wants his mother's love that she's showing to the doctor. And he wins, and he calls his mother, and he says, Mom, I want you to come to the inauguration and see me become president of the United States. The mother says, okay, I'll go. Mother goes. She's in the front row. She taps the person next to her as the president walks out on the stage and says, see that boy? He's my son. And the man says, that's very nice. He's your son. You know, his brother's a doctor.
Exactly. Well, okay.
Dr. Envy. My sister's a doctor.
And I know. I mean, I remember talking to your father about her, and as well as you. Now, what about your brother? Is there anchor envy?
There's a paycheck anchor envy, that I can tell you. He's doing a great job. I wish my father could. I wish my father could have seen Chris really come into his own because he has. I mean, I hate to say it but he's so damn good at what he does, and he's so smart. And you know, you can see Alan all of the training he had. Right, he was at the kitchen table all his life with the back and forth with my father and myself and. So he's doing a great job, and I really wish my father could see him. He'd be so proud.
Well, maybe he is. Maybe he is.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Governor, you know, from a very interesting topic to a topic that may turn some people off, and that is the budget. Hey, you know, the budget, those guys are going to do the budget again. We don't know what's in it. We don't want to know what's in it. Yet it is the guiding. The guidepost for everything that goes on in government.
Yes. And the budget this year is going to be different, Alan, because we've done a lot of good work legislatively, especially on social policy already, Reproductive Health Act, Child Victims Act, the Voting Reforms, DREAM Act. We'll do criminal justice reform, rent reform. But this budget is really going to be about the numbers. And in many ways, it's the most challenging budget that we have faced because the budget is ultimately about the economic trajectory of the state, and we have real economic issues. What they did to us in Washington with the tax reform and SALT, if we're not careful and we don't get this repealed, it could change the economic trajectory of this state. We've already seen over $2 billion in lost revenue. So this budget really is going to be a challenge on the numbers, and we have to be smart You know, they often accuse Democrats of showing love by giving money, right? The Italian grandmother gives food as a proxy for love. Democrats like to show attention by more money, more money, more money. And we don't have more money this year. And it would be fiscally irresponsible, I believe, if we're not cautious on what's going to happen with this economy. So the challenge really is going to be on the numbers. And on time is important, but being right is more important.
I'm sorry, Governor, don't they have to give back their pay raise if it's not on time? Isn't that part of the deal?
They don't. None of us get the annual adjustment, the executive or the legislative. But that's what's more important is that the budget is right. You know,
Doctor,
we have never had to come back and do a mid-year correction. And that's really the budget success that we've had. People focus on the timing. No.
Okay.
Focus on the number. We never came back and did a mid-year correction, and I don't want to start.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but okay. So assuming that is the case, obviously you and Tom DiNapoli are on the same page here. The comptroller and the governor are on the same page about what has to be done in order to not demand that you come back and fix things up later. What is that?
We have to be conservative on the revenue forecasts. We're at the point now where we set the revenue forecast, right? Budgeting for a state is a little different than budgeting for yourself because you normally know what the income is and you budget just expenses. We have both sides of the equation. We have to budget expenses but also project what the income is. And the income has been dropping. I believe it's primarily because of SALT and tax reform, but the income is dropping. The controller's estimate of revenue is actually below my estimate. My guess is the legislative estimates when they come in will be higher than my estimate of revenue. So that's the first piece to reconcile is what revenue projection do you take? And I believe the controller is going to be the lowest of all the estimates.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the internecine political warfare that's going on. Now, we know that you had some explosive words for the Senate Democrats and for the loss of the Amazon deal. But there are two different segments of the state Senate Democrats. There are the guys who you helped elect. I know you went and campaigned for them, and they were in the outlying areas, you know, Westchester, Long Island. They weren't in the city. And if you lost those, the Democrats would lose the Senate. So there seems to be a little bit of a war going on that I'm hearing about, which is that these marginal Democrats are afraid that the Assembly Democrats and the people who are the old Boys and Girls Club in the Senate will now turn around and do and try to spend all the money they can, where the Long Island guys and the Westchester guys are saying, no, don't do that. Is there anything to that?
Well, welcome to New York politics. There was a Senate minority leader, Democrat, who will go nameless, but once said to me, actually was talking to my father, and I was just hanging around, and he said, you know, it's very hard for the Democrats to ever hold the Senate because you have New York City politics and you have suburban upstate politics.
Interesting.
And they're enemies of each other, or they're at odds. I don't believe that to be true, but you do have different regional politics. And the challenge for the Democratic Senate is to be responsive to all, which you can be. As a statewide elected official, that's what I deal with every day, right? Making Buffalo work and the North Country work and Long Island work and New York City work. But there are regional differences in politics. There's no doubt about that. But that is also the art form of being in the majority. And, yeah, you will have ideological differences. You have a whole spectrum of Democrats, right? You see it nationwide. It's also true in this state. And you do have different needs in different regions. I'm going out to Buffalo today. You know, what they need in Buffalo is much different than what they need in New York City.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But is there a war going on between the left-wing Democrats and the more moderate Democrats in the burbs?
No, I think what you see is they've been in the minority and they've been doing politics. They're now in the majority and they're governing. Those are very different things. And this is a transition that they have to go through. And I think it's a learning process and feeling their way. But there will always be variations within a Democratic conference, whatever that Democratic conference is, the way there are variations in the Republican conference, by the way. We saw very big differences between more conservative upstate Republicans and more moderate Long Island Republicans, right? We've lived with that for years. And you now have that analog on the Democratic side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But come on now. You're going to be absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You
but
can't say yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you,
yeah. What
you,
does that mean?
Yeah, you know what it means. But there was, respectfully, you know what it means. But you and I both know that the Long Island Democrats, for example, were furious about the loss of the Amazon jobs, right? Yes or no?
Everybody was furious about the loss of the Amazon jobs.
Not everybody. Not everybody. So
everybody should have been furious about the loss of 25,000 jobs, the largest number of jobs this state.
But the Long Island Republic, but the Long Island Republicans and the Westchester, the Long Island Democrats and the Westchester Democrats, they were at odds with the Senate Democrats who basically, according at least to you last time we spoke, screwed up the deal.
Yeah, look, I think with Amazon, and I say what I think, as you know, and people like it, people don't like it. Amazon was a tremendous loss. And I don't believe it was just the suburban Democrats who feel that way. I believe it's, look, New York City, 75% of the people said it was a tremendous loss.
Yes,
in polls. So, yeah, everybody felt that way. It was it was a tremendous loss because it was.
I want to move to the MTA. You and Mayor de Blasio have gotten together, for those of us who drive into New York from time to time, below 60th or so, you're going to have to basically be easy passed, and it's going to cost you a lot of money to go and do that. Why'd you do that?
Because congestion is a problem in Manhattan. The environment is decaying around us, and because we need to finance a mass transit system. And the best way to finance it, rather than raising tolls on mass transit riders, I believe, is to toll cars coming into the Central Business District. The congestion in Manhattan is indescribable, Doctor.
Yes, it's true.
Buses move at 4 miles an hour, you know. You can probably walk faster if you had the stamina almost anywhere in Midtown Manhattan. So the congestion pricing says toll cars coming into the Central Business District. You can do it electronically. You can have variable tolls, incentivize people to drive in off hours. So it gives you much more flexibility, and it says we have to move out of vehicles, save the planet, reduce congestion, get onto mass transit, and here's the funding so we can actually have a mass transit system that people are willing to get on.
How is that mass transit thing going? You know, you've gotten some blame for the subways. You've gotten some credit for the Second Avenue subway, for example, but you've gotten some blame also, and there's been some question as to who's responsible, you or de Blasio. In the meantime, the subways are a mess.
Subways are a mess. It's been a governmental failure. It was designed almost as a failure. Governor Rockefeller did many great things, but they designed the MTA in a way that nobody had direct control because nobody wanted control, because nobody wanted to be responsible whether or not the trains ran on time. They didn't want to be responsible for fare increases. So they set up this Byzantine board of 17 people, and nobody knows who's responsible for what. We then didn't invest in the system because we're short-sighted and we don't pay for maintenance and we don't pay for upgrades. And now we have 40-year-old subway cars and 100-year-old electric switches. And every time it rains, the system ponds, forms puddles, and there are electrical short circuits. And now we have to go back and A, establish accountability and a management system that works, and B, invest and fix the system the way you should have been investing for all these years, literally 30 years of decline.
So let's go to A. What do you want to do to make it better? You want when it came down to education in New York, we said, okay, the mayor should be responsible. Should you be responsible and held responsible and forget about the MTA and appoint one administrator and that's it? You'll be responsible.
I think in an ideal world, doctor, yes. And I believe in accountability. And I have never shied away from taking responsibility as long as I have the authority. If I mess up the new Tappan Zee Bridge, it was me. If I mess up the Kosciuszko Bridge, it's me. If I mess up Albany Airport reconstruction, it's me.
So that's a yes, right? Do away with the MTA and Andrew Cuomo will be in charge.
Yeah, if the legislature would do that. The legislature now, talk about this, the dynamics, we have suburban members. It's the Long Island Railroad. It's Metro North, which is the Hudson Valley, Westchester. You then have New York City. They want to make sure everyone is represented. And that's the dynamic that we're dealing with now.
Well, can you win that fight?
I don't know. I don't know, because there is, with valid reason, they want to make sure that everybody has a voice at the table because it's a regional transit system. And that's how you wind up where we are with so many voices. It has to be better than it is now. And part of setting the tolls, and I said I will not support a toll increase unless there's a better management system. So it has to be better than it is now.
Right. Listen, I know you well enough to know that if you want something, really, really want it, this is the doctor speaking, if you really want it, you're going to get it.
I think that is, I wish that were true. I wish it were true. Look, I wanted a smaller nose. Did it happen?
All right. Speaking of going from one thing to another, you saw that Jumaane Williams, who ran against your intended and who successful Kathy Hochul as lieutenant governor, won in a special election for public advocate this week. Are there any hard feelings from the old days?
Oh no, I don't really know. Mr. Williams, but there are no hard feelings at all.
Because, as you know, that's a job that often leads to being the mayor of New York.
Has in the past.
Yeah. So you don't have anything good or particularly good about him to say, or anything particularly bad about him to say now.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So what about this? Oh, boy, I hate to ask you this because it's complicated, but the Public Authorities Control Board, the state Senate Republicans want to boost business this week by changing to a single member's veto power on the Public Authorities Control Board, which looms so large in the Amazon deal, of course. Do you agree with their ideas?
The Public Authorities Control Board, and there's something called CPRB, which require approval for the state to do basic projects. In the past, it has been used as a pocket veto. In this case, it was used to stop the Amazon deal, and nobody even knows what PACB stands for.
Right.
The legislature will say, well, that's our prerogative. Nobody has a prerogative to operate in secret with no transparency and stop major projects with a pocket veto. So, and that's true on both the PACB and the CPRB. I think there should be more transparency. You want to stop a project, you should stand up, say who you are, why you want to stop it, and if you stop it, there should be accountability. Not that the legislature can appoint a particular member to carry out a particular agenda.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the Republican proposal was, but I don't believe you should have that much power as a clandestine pocket veto. And you can appoint a member of the legislature who has a particular interest, right?
Sure. And we just saw that happen, didn't we?
Exactly.
We just saw it happen. You weren't pleased about it, Michael Gianaris. I had a letter from one of the members of the Senate majority now, the Democrats, who said all Cuomo had to do was say, okay, this guy won't suit, and we'll send somebody else up there. My response was, why should he do that? You knew what he was going to do. What do you make of that?
Well, it was an untruth. What that member was saying is this was just a political manipulation. That's all this was. We were playing politics with Amazon. We recommend Gianaris. The governor then says no to Gianaris. Gianaris looks like he accomplished his politics. It was all a manipulation. God forbid this state government falls to that level. Second, there was no replacement offered who had a different position, right? The Senate never said, okay, here's our second suggestion, and that person will support it. To this day, the Senate has never said they will support it. They sent up a second name, Senator Leroy Comrie, for the position, even though I never rejected the first selection. They set up a second person, Senator Comrie. He has never said whether he supports Amazon or not. And nobody's even asked the question, frankly, in our press corps. Or if they have, they took silence as acceptance. So it's just not true, Doctor.
Talk to me about the red flag gun control bill. You went up and talked with Speaker Pelosi. It's unlikely that such a law will prevail based on Republicans and the Second Amendment. Isn't that right?
You know, I've worked on the gun issue since I was in the federal government with President Clinton as HUD secretary. We passed the most sweeping gun agreement, and then it was undone by the Bush election. But the red flag bill is just common sense. And even gun owners will say, yes, if you're mentally ill, you shouldn't have a gun. If you're
what is that?
Arrested,
what's it?
You shouldn't have a gun.
And what's the definition on that? Does anybody who has ever seen an analyst have to worry that they'll never be allowed to own a gun?
No. You have, if a school teacher or family member primarily believe you are in extreme emotional distress and you can hurt yourself or others, they have the right to go to a judge. The judge then reviews the matter and can ask for an evaluation. So you have your right, but your rights intact. But if you're mentally ill and you can hurt yourself or others, then for your own well-being as well as others, someone should step in and help you. I mean, it's just common sense. Look, we in this society have decided that we can involuntarily institutionalize a person if they're in extreme danger to themselves or others. So it's just common sense. People who have a mental health issue that makes them incapable of handling a firearm should be helped.
How come, Gov, we're out of time. Can I take another 4 or 5 minutes with you?
Please.
Do you mind? Okay. There's a ban on stretch limousines that followed. You had a ban. You wanted the ban. But now you've dropped it from the budget. How come?
I want a ban on unsafe stretch limousines.
Right.
So there's a discussion, and a healthy, positive one. What is a safe versus an unsafe stretch limousine? The stretch limousines are an after-manufacturer process. Now, there is a federal certification on stretch limousines, which will preempt any state action. But we're not looking to ban all stretch limousines. It's those stretch limousines that may be dangerous because of how the work was actually done. Basically what you're doing is you're cutting a car in half and you're just adding 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 feet to it in the middle. It's not an easy manufacturing process, but there is a federal certification process, and that should govern and would govern.
Talk to me about marijuana. You've told me in the past we're going to get it in New York State. We have it in Massachusetts, where I live. Good state. And I know that you've said there's a competition for these tax dollars on marijuana. What can we expect?
I believe it is time. Massachusetts, New Jersey, we expect to legalize marijuana also. It is easier said than done, and it's not the devil is in the details, doctor, and you have to do it with safeguards and with protections. But I believe the remainder of the session, legalizing marijuana, criminal justice reform, rent reform will be the big sort of social issues. The biggest problem, as I said, is going to be the actual budget itself. And the dropping revenues, I believe the tax cap should be permanent in this environment. I believe we should do a middle class tax cut to keep people in this state and give them some stability. And that's going to be the bulk of the remainder of the agenda.
So you mentioned that you're going out west and to Long Island to promote a permanent tax cap. Now, as I mentioned before, that's something that the moderate Democrats in some of these places where people are really burdened by what they consider to be overtaxation are. Do you expect that the Senate and the Assembly will give you your permanent tax cap?
I think it would be foolish if they did not. I mean, in this economy, with this instability, with what the federal government did, we have to keep people in this state. We have to reassure people. And making the tax cap permanent, I believe, is an essential step in that. Look, we've had the tax cap. It's worked. And remember, the tax cap is not actually a cap, right? Local governments can exceed it.
At their own risk.
Well, at their own political risk.
Yes.
It's really fascinating. You know, somebody should do a study one day. Property taxes were going up 5, 6, 7, 8% a year. We then said, okay, there's a tax cap. You can exceed it, but you need a supermajority. And nobody exceeded it. How did you go from 5, 6, 7% every year to 2% every year? But they've done it, and it's worked very well. And I think making it permanent will be a very positive sign. And the Senate has already passed it. The Assembly hasn't. But I don't see how you can do a responsible budget without making the tax cap permanent.
Let's go on to something that is of interest to some of your upstate listeners, and that has to do with the arrest of Cohoes Mayor Sean Morse by the FBI, federal agents. Now, you've called on him to resign in the past. What are you thinking after today?
Well, look, these are federal. All I know is what I read in the newspaper, Doctor, but the federal charges.
Why do you keep calling me doctor? What's that?
Because
about?
And now we started with that whole doctor attorney competition and
my sister and
the mother. So I'm sticking with doctor now.
Well, my mother-in-law once was asked whether she really liked me, and she said we had always hoped her daughter would marry a doctor. And when they said, "Well, he is a doctor," say, "No, not that kind of doctor." So
not that kind of doctor. The type of doctor that wears surgical gloves. Well, you still operate, though.
Yeah, still an operator, right?
You just wear the gloves.
No question.
Do the surgery with a pen as opposed to a scalpel.
Right.
All I know is what I read in the newspaper, but there are obviously serious charges on the mayor.
You still think he should resign?
Yes.
Okay. So, do you exercise at all? Do you ever exercise?
Yes.
What do you do?
You want to go a few rounds? We can do a charity boxing match.
Yeah, not me. No, sir. So, but do you exercise? What do you do? Because I think people are concerned, about, your health and what you do. What do you do?
My weight is good. I watch my weight. I run. I basically run now. I work out. I will work out with light weights. I'm not like my brother Chris building mountains of muscle. But no, I stay in shape. It's important for me because this job is much different than when my father did the job. It is literally 7 days, 24 hours, any minute, anything can happen. Operational issues, climate issues, federal government attacking us.
Well, your pop played b-ball. I know that. He'd go out there and he'd play basketball.
Oh, yeah. That was his outlet. He played basketball. He played it with, we would play it against one another. He played it with Chris. Chris played, that's how he started. Chris played high school ball here in Albany. My father basically loved the competition of basketball.
Yeah. And people said he was mean, that he would give them the elbow and that he'd bring in state troopers to play on his team to help him out.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I want to ask you a serious question here.
That's
about
true.
I want to ask you a question about.
He wasn't mean, but he would hit you with an elbow.
I want to talk to you about the Cohn hearings. Did you watch?
I watched enough of it. Yes.
Okay. What'd you make of it?
Turns out, the end of the hearings, the president has lied, which we knew when the hearings started. Look, I don't know that anyone can be shocked at this point by any revelation about the president on any level. What else could be said about a person that hasn't been said about him? And this is a president who has just lost credibility in my mind. And this was another affirmation of it, colorful, from a person who knew, intriguing, but I don't think it actually breaks new ground,
I agree.
The talk shows had to say startling new. Yeah, president lied, president schemed, the president threatened, lied during the campaign. And in some ways, I'm worried that this is all a distraction from what government should be doing in Washington, like repairing the damage from their tax reform bill that devastated New York on SALT, like focusing on the red flag bill that Speaker Pelosi put in and actually doing something about gun violence. All this theater comes at a cost, Alan. we're not talking about government. It's all theater.
Governor, do you think, and I have to ask you this real quickly because I only got a minute left, but there is a rush on some part of our of the folks who follow all of this to impeach the president. I'm saying it's way too early because the Senate won't move on it right now, and you only get one shot. What do you think?
I think the Senate won't move. It would be a extend the theater. Forget the substance of it. You know, I think if you argue on the merits, if there was a president who should be impeached, this is a president in our lifetime who hits that standard. But practically, tactically, could you do it? Would it happen? And what is the cost of it? You know, I don't think we have a presidential election coming up. We're at the point where we should be focusing on, and when I say we, myself as a Democrat, we should be focusing on government, his failings in government, the divisiveness of this administration, and our positive plans, and what we're going to do as an alternative. And where is the Democratic Party as a party nationwide?
Okay, we have to go. But I wanted to just say, I take that's a no. It's too early to try to impeach him.
Take it as I agree with you, Doctor. I agree with you on your final question. You're right, Alan. You're right.
It's always great to talk to Andrew Cuomo. Thank you so much, Governor, for being with us. And we look forward to the next time, as we always do. Thanks again.
Thanks, Doc.